Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Did you know that Off Camera was also a television show? Well, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you know that we are a podcast, a magazine, and a television show. But what you may not know is you can watch full episodes in glorious black and white on our own website, offcamera.com. And now we've made that even easier by creating a monthly subscription so you can watch all the Off Camera you want. For only $4.99, you can subscribe to Off Camera and binge watch until the cows come home. And not only that, but new episodes pop up every week, so you can always stay up to date with the show. If you haven't yet checked it out, it's a whole different way to experience Off Camera. As you're listening to these stories, you can watch these thoughts form on these artists' faces, and it feels like you're right there in the room during the conversation. So check that out. It's a great option to the podcast, and it's also a great way to support the show. So check that out at offcamera.com. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with songwriter and guitar player Jason Isbell. Growing up poor to parents barely past their own adolescence was not without its struggles. But luckily for Jason Isbell, familial bonds run deep in rural Alabama. Unable to afford daycare, Jason's parents often dropped him at his grandparents, where he spent the day playing music. As Jason says, from the time I was 7 years old, I would take this huge dreadnought guitar and play old gospel rhythms and country with my granddad. It was bluegrass all day long, and that was my first real interaction with anything creative. Jason's obsession with the guitar was evident to his family. So much so that the one punishment that was off limits was taking away said guitar. He even slept with the guitar because once he realized he could play, being a musician was the only thing that entered his mind. His passion and focus led him to the live music scene in Muscle Shoals, a recording studio mecca in Alabama. He played alongside seasoned musicians like David Hood, who provided wisdom and expertise to Jason, whose confidence was, in his words, way beyond where it should have been. Eventually, Jason joined David Hood's son's band, Drive-By Truckers, which exposed him to the spoils and temptations of the rock and roll lifestyle. After a number of tumultuous years with the Truckers, Jason realized that collaboration was not necessarily his strong suit. After a stint in rehab, Jason began his solo career and formed his own band, the 400 Unit. And wait till you hear the origin of that name. Since that time, Jason has developed into one of the greatest songwriters of his or any other generation, as evidenced by his singing and songwriting on Southeastern, Something More Than Free, and his newest album, The Nashville Sound. It's refreshing to sit down with an artist who is so focused on protecting the integrity of his art, because, as he says, good art reminds you of your similarities rather than your differences, and bad art reminds you so much of your differences. Jason joins Off Camera to discuss the moment he discovered that he was a songwriter, how there's no such thing as writer's block, and why it's cool to walk around with his pants down. Emotionally, that is. He also plays us a song. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
I am a big fan of your music, and I was blown away when the Nashville Sound came out. And it seems like with each record, your songwriting gets more personal, more specific. And for me, being older now, I don't find a lot of records I connect with like I connected with the Nashville Sound. And I don't know if that's my problem or if music isn't doing it like it used to.
It's because I make old man music, Sam.
Is that what
that's
it is?
That's what it is.
Well, that's good to know
yeah.
for all the old men watching
yeah.
that there's someone still making old man music.
Old men are cool again, though. So
that's right.
Young people will listen to my music, too.
Is that, you think so?
No, but I hope so.
Well, I got to ask you about the name, the 400 Unit,
mm-hmm.
what that means and where that came from.
Yeah, it was the mental treatment facility in the town where we grew up in North Alabama. And they've since changed the name. I don't know if that's my fault or not, but that's what they call the part of the hospital where people went who had mental issues and couldn't, you know, their family would take them there and check them in. And, you know, the overnight stayers would stay in the 400 unit. And now it kind of seems a little bit insensitive, but we've just had the name for so long that I'm not going to change it at this point.
Right.
And once a week, you know, they would take the healthier folks downtown Florence and in Alabama, and they would give them, you know, $10, and they would let them out. They would be wearing name tags that said they were from the 400 unit, and they would let them out, and they would go to a sandwich shop or, you know, go get some coffee or whatever. And then after an hour or so, they'd all load back up in the van. And after we'd been touring for a little while, I noticed that we would stop in a town, and we would get out of the van. I'd give everybody $10.
Did you put name tags on them so they didn't
No, we didn't have to put name tags, but a couple of days we should have. But they would, you know, we would go and walk around in a little town and get some lunch. And the locals kind of looked at us the same way that you know, we would look at the 400 unit when they would go out on their outings, their excursions, because we looked pretty haggard. The van travel is that's no way to do it. That's a hard life.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It brings up a question about what you would be doing with your life if you didn't play music, or could you imagine doing anything else?
It, you know, I never wanted to do anything. There was no astronaut or fireman or anything like that for me. It was just this, because I started playing super early with my family, and my grandparents played and sang in church, and, you know, my aunts and uncles all played. My parents didn't, but you know, all the daycare that we had was with family members, so they you know, couldn't really afford to put me in a daycare or hire a babysitter or a nanny or anything like that. So they would take me to my grandparents' house, and my granddad would play old time music, gospel music, and old country music. You know, from the time I was 7 or 8 years old, I would have to take this huge acoustic dreadnought guitar and, you know, play old, like, gospel rhythms and country, and it's just dum 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 dum, like bluegrass all day long, you know. And
wow.
So that was, you know, my first real interaction with, you know, anything creative. And I didn't realize until much later that, you know, that obviously he wanted to bond with me and have something we could do together, but it also kept me from breaking everything in his house, you know, or getting outside and falling off a ladder or something. It just served a lot of purposes, you know.
Right.
But I never, once I figured out that people did that and that was their job, you know, as opposed to my dad, whose job was, you know, doing maintenance at a hospital or working at a tool and die shop or painting houses with my granddad, which he did for a long time. You know, when I realized, oh, this, I can play this instrument, and that's an option, and I don't have to do the other stuff, then there was never any idea that entered in my mind other than being a musician. For me, it was just, I'm just going to keep doing this. You know, I'm just going to keep playing this instrument until all the things that I want to happen in my life have finally happened.
I wonder what gave you that focus as a kid to know, like, I'll just stick with this thing and it will see me through.
That's the ultimate question, you know. I mean, I've often thought of talent as just the enjoyment that you get from the start, from the first time you do something, you love it so much that you never have to make yourself practice. You know, you have to, like, I had to force myself to do other things, like my homework or eat or socialize or be a kid. You know, there was never any time to practice the guitar. It was just always time to put the guitar down and go bathe myself. You know, that was just it. It was all I ever wanted to do.
It's mysterious. Like, it must feel at times almost like that was chosen for you.
Yeah, it's a gift. You know, it really is a gift, and I think that's what that means to me. The gift of, you know, I had a focus, and it's been heartbreaking sometimes in my life to run across people who I care about a lot who, you know, don't have a gift like that. They don't have one thing that they love so much, you know, that they're going to do it for the rest of my life, for the rest of their lives. Like, you know, I remember when my little brother was 11 or 12 years old, and I was talking to my mom on the phone. I was like, has he showed any interest in anything in particular that he might want to do, you know? And she said, well, I think he might want to play baseball. And I said, well, look out the window. Does he have a baseball in his hand right now? And she said, no. And I said, he's not going to play baseball for a living. You know, it's like I slept with a guitar in the bed. And it just, that was it. That was all I cared about, you know. I just knew there's this one thing that always makes me feel good. Always makes me happy. If I can get through whatever, you know, my parents getting a divorce or, you know, whatever trouble I was having at school or, you know, normal troubles a teenage kid has, you know, if I can just get to the point where I'm in my room with the guitar, I'll be cool. I'll be fine. And that was just every day. That was like the thing that I looked forward to the most, you know. Even so much so that my parents wouldn't, you know, that was the one punishment that was off limits, you know, no matter what I did.
Oh, like, really?
Yeah, they would not take the guitar away. They would not, because I would completely shut down, you know, if it was even threatened. It was like, you know, that just wasn't on the table.
Was there someone that first recognized you have talent and sort of, like you say, your parents wouldn't take the guitar away?
Yeah.
Was there some sort of understanding at a certain age?
Yeah. Totally, yeah, yeah. I remember a lot of, like, with them, with my grandparents, there was definitely, you know, a lot of, like, you know, looking sideways at me, like, whoa, you know, how did you figure that song out? Or, you know, I remember my uncle, who, my dad's brother, he was in a band that covered a bunch of Southern rock songs, and, you know, they practiced in their buddy's garage, and I would go over and fall asleep on the weight bench listening to them play Neil Young and Skinner and stuff like that, you know. And I remember him, you know, there's a couple of songs that I would just watch him play, and then I would go, you know, he never taught them to me. He would just play them, and I would see him play them. And then I remember him saying, "Where did you learn? I didn't show you how to play that, you know." And I would be like, "Well, I watched you play it with your band, you know, the other night at practice, and then I went home and figured it out." And so that those were the first moments when, you know, there were people around me that were like, "Oh, you have something special," you know.
Right. Well, one of the things that I like about your writing is that you write a lot about your upbringing, mm-hmm. which I feel like all my songwriting heroes do,
yeah.
Because if they write well enough about their upbringing, they're writing about everybody's upbringing.
Right. I mean, that's the eternal Rubik's Cube. You know, that's the problem that we're all trying to solve throughout adulthood. We're still working on the same problem.
So as a songwriter, absolutely.
I'm still trying to explain what happened to me when I was 8 years old to myself now. You know, those things are, they're milestones. They're things that, like, they stick with you for the rest of your life. So if you're trying to create something, it's like, well, what's the thing that I'm most concerned with today? There's always some part of your childhood in the back of your mind. It's like, hey, you still haven't brought me out of the cabinet and talked to me yet, you know?
Right. Well, you have this song, Children of Children, which is about your parents being so young. And I think it's very nakedly autobiographical.
Yeah, that one's me, yeah.
And in it, there's a line where you say, when I think of all the years I took from her just by being born.
Yeah.
That it made me wonder what it was like to have parents that were that young and how that sort of shaped you, because you weren't looking at someone that had it all figured out.
I mean, there are definitely a lot of positives to it. You know, my parents had a lot of energy. They were able to go out and, you know, play ball with me and run around and chase me, and, you know, inexhaustible energy, because my dad was 19, my mom was 17, I think, when I was born.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, they were kids. And there was a lot of all of us figuring things out together sort of at the same time, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes I would figure out, oh, you're not supposed to do that with a kid before they would. and they would have to agree.
Oh, what's you're an right. example of that?
You're right. This is probably not the best idea. You know, things like standing up in the passenger seat of the car. Like, I remember, you know, one time when I was little, I was standing up. My dad had this old pickup truck that he had let the shop class at the high school rebuild and restore it. And it was a project for them that semester. So Dad had to wait the whole school year to get his truck fixed, but he couldn't afford to have it done.
He figured it may take longer, but I'll get the work done for free.
Yeah, for free. Yeah. So that's what Dad did with this old, it was, you know, 50s Chevrolet pickup truck. And just a couple days after he got the thing back, I mean, after waiting that long, my mom was driving down the highway that runs across the state line from Alabama to Tennessee, and I was standing up in the passenger seat, and there was one of those big old Electrolux vacuums in the bed of the truck that was about the size of this table, you know, big robot R2-D2 vacuums. And somebody hit the back of the truck, and so, of course, the vacuum slammed up against the back glass, and, you know, I went flying. Mom reached over to try to grab me, and I kind of went flying across the front of the truck. Didn't really hurt myself at all, you know, but it was one of those things where she kind of looked at me after and went, "That probably wasn't the best way for you to be riding in a vehicle. Sorry, you know, I'm 24. What do you expect? Just trying to get you to your grandma's house and get her vacuum cleaner back to her."
Well, I think one of the other things that's interesting about that is that it probably puts you around your grandparents a lot more than if you had older parents, right?
Yeah, and I think that's honestly a bit of the secret to why a lot of the really good music that came out of the place where I grew up, and I think that's part of why it happens a lot in rural areas and in places where, you know, there's a concentration of either, you know, poor country people or immigrants or, you know, people who have to trust that family bond in a very physical way every day for their own survival. I think a lot of really good art over the years has come out of those type of little enclaves.
Because the elders are interacting with the kids.
Yeah, all generations are interacting together every single day, and that doesn't necessarily happen, you know, if you've got a little bit of money.
Were you in high school? Were you, because I would think in where you grew up, the main thrust of the high school wasn't turning out sensitive poets, or
you wouldn't think that.
I wondered if you often were underestimated, or the thing you could do was not necessarily
right. Yeah. I was not like super cool. I was not a rock star in high school by any means. You know, I was like a band nerd.
Yeah,
I made really good grades. Had a small but loyal group of buddies that I hung out with. Most of the people that I grew up around, you know, they hunted and played football and did all the stuff kids in Alabama do. You know, raised hell, big trucks, and out in the middle of a field, lit stuff on fire, and, you know, drank until somebody blew their hand off with something, and then, you know, it's that kind of like real pre-methamphetamine. You know, rural Alabama,
pre-methamphetamine.
Yeah, which, you know, that was a golden era for the redneck. You know? It was before meth came in and, you know, messed it all up. That period there, you could drink 1,000 beers. You know,
yeah,
it's like Valhalla for those 18-year-old kid with a pickup truck. But yeah, it didn't really hit us hard until the 90s, and then everything just got real dark.
God, well, it makes me wonder, like, from an early age, did you sort of develop a sense that I got to go find my people?
And I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
I got to get out of here was very important to me.
But at the same time, you're right down the road from Muscle Shoals, so you have this dichotomy of being this place where some of the greatest music is made.
Yeah, but Muscle Shoals is famous as a studio hub and a recording music capital, you know, which it never, the doors to that aren't open to a teenager. But what we would do, and some of this worked to my benefit, but like the laws there were so, you know, alcohol sales were so heavily restricted, Bible Belt blue laws, that they had to sell more food than alcohol. You know, places got closed.
Oh, restaurants and bars.
Yeah, they couldn't be a bar. The bar couldn't exist. It had to be a restaurant. So for me at 15, that was great because my parents could take me to the Mexican restaurant that was basically a bar on Friday night, and the house band would be playing for 4 hours, and, you know, they would drive me and drop me off. And
you would sit in with the adults.
I would sit in with the adults, You know, these guys would be, they still lived in the area, and since there wasn't really a live music scene, they'd be out playing and working on Friday, Saturday nights, playing, covering songs that they had played on the original versions of sometimes.
So what was your level of confidence at that age? Like, did you know, like, oh, I've got something here, or would you?
It was way beyond where it should have been, way beyond. I was a switch. It was like, you know, the guitar got plugged in and turned on, and I just went.
So fascinating that as a kid you had access to those kinds of players, and they took you under their wing.
Yeah, super, super lucky. I remember one day it occurred to me when I was in my 20s, it's like, that was not part of their job. They didn't get paid to do that. They were trying to pay their bills and work just like everybody else. But, you know, they would take the time. David Hood, man, he still calls me his son. You know, he he would take time to tell me things like, just show up on time, make sure all your gear works. You know, very often you're going to be the only guy at the session that shows up on time, and that's always going to look great.
Right.
And so that was huge for me, was, you know, him taking me when I was 16, 17 years old and saying, be more professional than the guy next to you. You don't always have to be a better player than him. You know, if he might be a better player than you, but if you show up with a guitar that works and sounds great and you're there on time, you're going to get the gig.
So let's fast forward a little bit to the Drive-By Truckers, which David's son, Patterson, started that band.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that was his baby.
So, but they were a bit older than you, right?
Yeah, they were closer to my parents' age.
Well, I wondered if there's any way to sort of handle when you go from one level to all of a sudden you're just in this band and the whole thing opens up for you.
Mm-hmm.
If it was almost, I don't know, to be 20, 21 years old and hop into that level, if it was almost like the kid in the candy store.
Yes, it was a lot like that. Yeah. I don't know if there's a, outside of just surviving it, you know, and hoping to learn from it and enjoying as much of it as possible. I don't know if there's a formula for what to do in that situation. But yeah, I mean, it was very much like an overdose of freedom, you know, for me. You know, if you have a certain amount of talent and you're playing in a band that's doing pretty well, a lot of things get excused or overlooked, you know. So, yeah, I got out of hand, you know, drinking way too much and just doing all kinds of stuff that I had to quit doing, you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, I don't regret those things. And a lot of it was a whole lot of fun. It really was. And now I don't have to wonder, what's it like to, you know, drink a gallon of whiskey and try to get on stage. Now I know what that's like, you know.
Was it that crazy? Like,
yes.
It was
that crazy.
Yeah. And from David Hood telling you a few years ago to be on time and do all of this, and then jumping into his son's band and being in that situation, how did you put those two things together?
I don't know if I did. I probably forgot David's advice for a while, to tell you the truth, and then remembered it again years later.
Right.
You know, it was never like big rock star level or anything, but it was big enough to where, you know, people certainly were taking notice and people were buying records and coming to shows. And that feeling was really, like, you know, I was over the moon about that. But the whole time I was in somebody else's band, you know, so there was part of that that I definitely resented over the years. And, you know, taking drugs and drinking and having some kind of resentment, those things don't mix very well at all. So, you know, as it got later on, you know, the things that used to be hangovers and you know, recovering from the good times wound up being arguments over, you know, whose songs went on the record or how we played this or that, or, you know, how out of tune were you last night, or, you know, it all blended into one big problem over time.
Did they think they were hiring like a hot guitar player and they had no idea what the songwriter you were going to become?
Patterson knew the songs. He had heard some of my songs, and he hadn't heard the ones that wound up being Trucker's songs, but he had heard some of the songs that I had written.
Okay.
But Patterson knew what he was doing by putting me in that role. I think he knew how that would play out.
And that was going to become a three-headed monster.
Yes, I think he knew that.
And there was going to be a three-act structure.
Yeah, I don't think he wanted to tell me that. You know, he didn't want to tell me. Yeah, right. He saw it all the way through the Shakespearean ending. But, you know, he didn't want to tell me that, you know, I'm going to bring you into the band. Maybe you can write some songs for us. He was smart enough to come play guitar. You know, if it works out, we'll keep you on as a guitar player, you know, maybe just for this record. And then by the time we finished that tour, I brought outfit and decoration day, got up in the morning before everybody else did and wrote those songs. And, you know, so after that, it was like, all right, you know, I think we should record those too for the next record. And there we went.
Wow. So when you got in that band, was your plan like, I'm not just going to be the third guitar player here? Like, did you have sort of your own?
No, I really just went in, you know, to play guitar. because at that time I didn't have a whole awful lot of confidence in myself as a songwriter.
You didn't?
No, I still really thought of myself as a guitar player first and foremost in those days. I kind of do still now, really.
Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing I feel the most comfortable with. I mean, I've been doing that for, you know, 30 years, longer than 30 years, and I'm not 40 yet. So I still feel like a guitar player, but I just learned how to write songs. But after a little time with that band, I thought, well, maybe some of the songs that I've started on or some of the ideas that I've had about my family, you know, it might could fit with what they're doing. You know?
Right. When you wrote Outfit, which I think is such a great song, and it's sort of, it's your father giving you advice, mm-hmm. right? But I think it's also a cautionary tale in a way, in the sense that, you know, your father says, or in the song, the words are, you know, don't call what you're wearing an outfit, don't say that your car is broke.
Yeah.
But then it's, don't let me catch you with a bucket of rich man's paint.
Yeah, don't wind up where I am.
Right, and you know, it made me curious if your dad ever shared with you, because his dreams couldn't have been to be a house painter,
yeah.
or to be a laborer. And I wonder if he ever shared with you, like, the dreams he had or the things he wanted to do.
Yeah, he has. You know, we're really close, and I've heard more of that in the last 10 years than I ever did before, because I think he compartmentalized those things when he was raising me, because, you know, he didn't want to put that burden of, you know, this is what I dreamed of doing, look where I am now. But
he didn't want to put it on you.
He didn't want to put it on me, yeah.
But it comes out in that song. It comes out as there's a wisdom to that of in the advice that he's giving you, he's revealing himself.
Yeah, there's a slip. And that's the character. And that's really kind of the crux of the song. And that's what a lot of people miss, you know. A lot of people think it's a song that's just about the love between a father and a son. But also, yeah, that idea that you see a little bit more of who he is through what the information he accidentally gave me in giving me that advice. You
right.
know? And that's the ultimate point of the song, is really it's just like a character study, you know, just like most of those personal narrative songs are. It's just, I just want you to know who he is. That's it.
When you wrote that, did you say, oh, I'm a songwriter? Like, was that one of the first times where you said...
Yeah, I think so. That was probably... That one and Decoration Day, they were both on that same album.
Yeah.
And, that I thought then that I was a songwriter, I think. Doesn't necessarily mean I liked those songs immediately upon finishing them, you know, because it is like, you know, walking around with your pants off. And
when you write an autobiographical song.
Yeah. Or do anything autobiographical. It's so terrifying until you get really, really super used to it. And then guess what? You're the guy that's never wearing any pants. And nobody wants to be around you. It was not something I necessarily enjoyed yet. It took me many years of writing songs to enjoy the process of it. But I did feel legitimate. You know, that was the only thing I think I ever really needed to feel legitimate, was like singing those songs back to myself and going, those are real songs. You
but
know?
They had to grow on you.
Yeah, they had to grow on me. Now,
or maybe like you had them. To grow into them.
I think possibly, you know. I think I had to do a lot of tests, you know, as my ability to write songs got better, as I took in more as far as songs and literature and, you know, art in general, if they still held up, you know, if they passed all those tests over the years. And I think those two definitely do. You know, I still play them a lot, and uh-huh. I don't ever think, man, I wish that line was something different. You know, more often than not, I'll get halfway through one and think, yeah, this is pretty good, you know, for a 21-year-old kid.
Well, I want to get more into songwriting, but I do want to ask you before we move off the Drive-By Truckers chapter. It was a very tumultuous time in your life, and you ended up getting asked to leave the band. Mm. And I wonder if you could point to one specific thing that maybe you were fighting against, or if it's just the classic thing of some people are born alcoholics and they discover at a certain age, or you know what I mean? I wonder if you look back at that time and say, oh, I know now what I was really fighting, and it wasn't the things I thought I was fighting.
So you're asking if I've got it all figured out.
Yeah, that's why
have
you're
I figured
here.
Myself out completely? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I wasn't born an alcoholic. I didn't really get it genetically. Luckily for me, I think that might have given me a little bit of a leg up when I tried to quit, you know.
Okay, yeah.
But, yeah, I have identified some of the issues. You know, one of them, and this is probably on a very basic level, I've found that I work best when I'm either in charge or I'm being told what to do. I don't collaborate well. Ah. No, not in the true nature of the term collaborating. You know, if I'm playing guitar on my wife's albums, I'm really happy. You know, you tell me what to play and I'll play it, and it's great. You know, if it's my album, if it's my project, you know, I want to at least retain veto power over everything. Everything. You know, what shoes the drummer's wearing. Luckily, our drummer wears good shoes. I don't have to worry about that. Sometimes I'll send a suggestion, but you know what I mean. Like, if somebody were to walk on stage with some terrible shoes, I want the opportunity to say, take those off.
I understand that more than you know.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do.
Please continue.
But anything in between, I don't like sharing a vision. I don't like painting half of a picture of my mom and then handing it to a stranger to finish it. And that happens every damn day in Nashville, you know. There are people writing songs. And first I have to tell you about my life experience before you're going to get anywhere near the idea of understanding, you know, what I'm trying to get out on a piece of paper. Not interested.
Right.
I'm not interested in that. I mean, you got to really know me, because I don't want... I would rather just say, fuck it, I'll just write it myself, you know, and save us all the trouble of backstory, because you're not going to understand why this Randall knife was so important to Guy Clark. You know, imagine if he tried to sit down with a team of songwriters and written a song like that. You know?
Right, right. So what you're saying is that you had to find out in your 20s that you were an uncompromising artist and this was not your environment.
That's a nice way of putting it, yeah. But that probably wasn't as much the issue as, you know, there were just a lot of personal things that I had not dealt with from growing up sheltered in, you know, the extremely religious Deep South and having whatever brain that I had, you know, both good and bad, that started questioning those things really intensely from an early age, and then eventually thought, wow, a lot of this doesn't make sense to me anymore, and I need to get out of this place. And it was the full adult dose of the world immediately.
And
yeah. I did not have the tools for that, man. I didn't know where to put that. You know, I didn't have enough drawers to unpack those bags.
Were you hard on yourself when it didn't work out?
Yeah, very much so. And then I'd let those people down, because, you know, when you're in an independent rock band, you have to be like family, you know, for better or worse. So more so than the ruining of the opportunity, I felt terrible for letting those people down.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Has your company outgrown QuickBooks? Are shared spreadsheets, manual processes, and legacy systems costing you time and money? Well, now's the time to move your business to the cloud. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform. With NetSuite, you can save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance and accounting, orders, and HR instantly, right from your desk or even your phone. Thousands of the best-known brands and fastest-growing companies use NetSuite to manage their business. And now it's available to you. The power of the world's most popular cloud management system is more affordable than you think. Right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights to overcome the obstacles that are holding you back for free. Don't miss out on unleashing your business's full potential with this free guide, Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth. You'll learn how to acquire new customers, increase profits, and finally get real visibility into your cash flow. Get NetSuite's guide, Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth, when you go to netsuite.com/offcamera. That's netsuite.com/offcamera. So check that out. And now let's get back to the show.
Getting into songwriting a little bit, there's a song on the Nashville Sound called Hope the High Road. And right off the bat, in the beginning of that song, you are criticizing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so right there, as a listener, I can say, oh yeah, there's things I used to think that I think were dumb now, and what am I, you know, and I'm putting this in a very pedantic way, but point being that that song is almost a political statement in terms of I'm an individual, I'm going to make up my own mind, I'm through following what I'm supposed to do or what other people expect of me. And I felt like I knew you when I heard that song. Do you feel like when you write a song like that, you're almost just speaking your truth, and it just so happens that you're good enough of a craftsman to make it feel like a song?
Maybe so, yeah. I mean, yeah, when it's done right, I think that's the case, that you're just being yourself on paper. You want it to seem overheard. The kind of music that I like, now, you know, I'm not saying this is the right way to do it, but if you want to do it like I do it, then you have to write something that you could have overheard in a bar or in a grocery store, in a restaurant, somebody else's conversation, or something that you would have said to somebody. You know, it's more about noticing, or it should feel like it's more about noticing than creating.
Right.
Now, really, it is all very carefully and very slowly sculpted, but it should feel like I just heard that one day.
Do you think that you are a born observer? Like, do you pick up on things that you later, they hit you in the... Because I think one of the things that great songwriters can do is they can notice things almost like an alien would, like if an alien came down to Earth and saw the way a couple was having dinner, they could pick up on all the strangeness. Like, there's a trick to noticing things and expressing them in a way that lets us see ourselves. And I think that happens in your songwriting.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think all different kinds of art, you know, the stuff that I like the most is that stuff that, you know, focuses on how two people interact or how somebody interacts with the outside world and looks at it from a perspective that is detached, you know, but then makes for less detachment from the viewer to the subject.
You can remove the filters because you were not in it.
Because I'm not in it, yeah, which is almost like...
Which gets you further in it.
Yeah, it does, which is almost like a little bit sociopathic in a way. You got to be real careful about that because...
Oh, because you could be sort of observing your own interactions.
Yeah, and not care.
Your wife or...
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you could be just going through the motions or, you know, putting on a face. But you know, I think for me, the way I create, it is about looking for a perspective that hasn't been found before.
Right.
You know, where can I put the camera that nobody's ever put the camera before?
That's a great example because it's almost like saying, I'm going to find a new point of view for you to look at this thing that you've overlooked 1,000 times, and now you're going to see it for the first time.
I'm not giving it meaning. It has meaning. I'm just going to try to show you that by just, hold on, step over here. You know, you can't see the sunset right here. Just step over here in front of the window a little bit.
Is there an example where you made sort of a breakthrough where you discovered that you had that ability or a song when you were able to get to something that you've been trying to in the past but hadn't done it with as much specificity or precision?
Elephant was a big one for that. That was a big one. That made me feel... If Outfit and Decoration Day made me think I was a songwriter, Elephant made me think I was a really good songwriter. You know, and because when that one was done, I could look back and there's no fat. You know, it was exactly what it needed to be. And it was the details that I chose that I think made it work that way. That song, I felt like I got everything that I needed to get in there and nothing more. And so that was the point where I thought, okay, you know, I have created a story out of pieces of other stories and made it so that I will always feel like these people exist at least 3 times a week when I'm up on stage singing it to people.
Well, that brings up a question. I wonder what happens to you when you play and you are the narrator and you have to be able to deliver that story over and over again. And I wonder what happens to you on stage that you're allowed to do that.
Some of the songs have rules. They don't all have rules for performing them, but some of them, Elephant has rules
for me.
Like, I can't look at Amanda and laugh in the middle of that one. Not okay, you know, because there's always, without fail, somebody weeping in the front row. So I can't, you know, turn around and make a joke to the drummer during the instrumental section of that song. And
you have a responsibility during that song.
Yeah, yeah. And there are a few songs that are like that, you know. Dress Blues is one of those. I can't, that's got to be kind of sacred territory every night, you know. I'll play them at 2 in the afternoon, you know, on the main stage at Bonnaroo for a bunch of kids wearing nothing. I'll do that, but I'm not going to laugh in the middle, and I'm not going to, you know, it's not a party song. I'm going to try to honor, you know, the characters, real or fictional, because that's not really who you're honoring in Elephant, you know, because those people are combinations of people.
But sure,
everybody who's been affected by that song afterward, you know, you have to be respectful of their story. I mean, there's a lot of them, more so for that song really than anything I've ever done, I think. You know, people just came from everywhere to say, you know, my significant other or my parent or my child or my friend was dying of cancer, and this song, you know, really spoke to me in a way that was not patronizing or condescending. It was just, you know, somebody just heard, you know, what I was throwing out into the universe. So,
right,
you know, you have to really be aware of that. And, you know, I'll never go on autopilot during those songs. Not really during any, if I can help it. If I catch myself thinking of something other than the story I'm trying to deliver, I'll cut that off.
When you write a song like Elephant, does it set the bar?
I think so, in some ways. You got to be careful with that, you know. As you know, you do something that's really good, you don't want it to freeze you up in the future.
I mean, have you ever felt that?
Maybe so, but I've always kind of been able to work through it. I think you can work through anything, you know. I think you just keep on plumbing until the leak has stopped, you know. I mean, that's
I like
it,
that,
you know. But yeah, I have felt it, but I've never acted. I've never let that stop the wheels from turning.
Right.
Because I know what I did to get there. Like that's the thing. I didn't stumble on Elephant by some magical process. I stumbled on it by working and editing and you know, going through the steps that I have gone through since to write other songs. So I know that if I do this again, it's going to work again. And I know that now about songs that I've not written yet, you know. I'm not going to write any bad ones.
Because we won't see those.
No, you won't see those. Unless my wife forgets what a bad song is, you'll never hear a bad song from me. Because she will tell me if I need to fix something.
Oh, is that true?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that, you know, I feel really fortunate to have that and to be able to hear it, you know. Because a lot of people who write their own songs or do their own, you know, a lot of solitary creatives, they don't have anybody around them, especially by the time that when they've made a little bit of money, got a little bit of success, you know.
No one's going to tell them.
Nobody's going to tell them no. But Amanda sees the songs before anybody else does, and they're not done until she says they're done.
Tell me about that, because obviously you were writing songs before you met her, and your process, I'm sure, evolves like anybody else. But is there a routine or a process that you could say that you stick to all the time?
Like, it's different every time.
It is.
You know, sometimes I'll start repeating a phrase and I'll find chords and a melody, and then sometimes I'll just sit down with a guitar and go, I'm gonna write a song today. You know, that's kind of the hardest way to do it, because it is starting from scratch, you know, and that's probably the ones that I wind up getting the least out of as far as, you know, keepable material. The ones that work best for me are ones where, like, I'll have something. Usually I'm occupying the right side of my brain, you know, doing something menial, driving, or something that takes the taskmaster and puts him over here.
Rather than sitting at the desk with a blank piece of paper.
Yes, yes, because then you got both sides of your brain just fighting each other. You know, unless you just woke up and the taskmaster has not quite had his coffee yet, it's really hard to get him to shut the hell up long enough for the creative part of your brain to start working and taking over. You know, I think that's why a lot of people write when they get up in the morning, because the part of you that's been dreaming has been up all night, you know.
Do you ever approach it like a journalist? Like, you talk about observing and picking up on phrases and writing like real people talk. Like, do you ever consider that part of the job, like, to kind of keep one ear turned if you go out to dinner? Or do you write down a phrase when you hear it?
Yeah, all the time.
That's maybe the neatest trick of a songwriter, is that you, by nature of what you're trying to do, you have to examine things closer than the average human being walking around the street.
Yeah.
And the gift that a songwriter can give is by that, through that examination, they can reflect humanity back at us a little bit better. Because am I off my rocker thinking that you could learn how to be more empathetic or more understanding of the human psyche by the fact that you are trying to write a really lean song about it?
No, I think you're exactly right. That's why I think you should listen to good music and not listen to bad music. You know, that's the whole point of when I get angry about something being widely consumed and hugely successful that I think really sucks and is really formulaic and, you know, corporate and just crap. You know, that's why it makes me mad. That's why I can't just say we're all fine listening to whatever we want to listen to, because I do think there's some kinds of art that make you a better person. You know, whether you're consuming it or trying to create it, I think that's it helps you to build a better understanding of what other people are like really in there, inside there, what they're like, you know. It reminds you more of your similarities rather than your differences. And I think bad art reminds you so much of your differences.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, because you think, man, these people...
I'm not connecting with them at
I'm
all.
Not, no. They're singing about things that I don't care about. But there are people out there who must care about it because they've sold 10 million records. So all of a sudden you feel alien.
You know, there's a line in Hope the High Road where you say there's got to be more of us than them.
Yeah, there can't be more of them than us, yeah. And it's a little bit homespun, you know, a little bit... Come on, guys, you know, let's get in line. But it's also there's frustration there, and that was one of the lines in the song that my concern about that was, did I show too much of my own hand in that line? Because it is frustrating. It's like there can't be more. Seriously, there can't be. But it's a question. It's a question. I'm not saying there are more of us than them. You know, I'm saying there can't be more of them than us. You know, so there's that. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there are. You know.
But that's why I think I connect with you as an artist, and I connect with that song because those are the same questions I ask myself.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know the answer.
Do you find that when you are honestly in a song, just throwing out your own, you know, queries, and then it comes back to you that, oh wow, a lot of people are. That's not unique to me. That thought is, like, has being a songwriter taught you that your really unique and specific thoughts are actually really universal?
Yes, and that is humiliating.
You think you're special or original?
Yeah, that's what humiliating is at the root of it. You know, is. Really, it's also the same thing as connecting with people, finding out you're human, you're being humiliated. We all, you know, look weird with our pants off, you know. We all wonder about these same questions.
Do you ever wonder the meta level of, like, why you've sort of chosen to be the guy that's going to put his pants down first for everybody else to go, oh, that's how I look with my pants down too?
No, because, man, Kris Kristofferson looked cool with his pants off, you know. Joni Mitchell looked awesome with her pants off. It's like people have done this very same thing that I'm doing so well, and I look at them and they really look cool. So it's like, can't be that bad.
But I love, though, that you said earlier that it took some time to get used to the idea that that's what your job was.
Yeah, that was a hard thing because... You know, I never wanted to be a writer. I wanted to write. You know,
what's the difference?
Well, I think I needed to say things that, you know, my vehicle was songwriting. I needed to get those things out of me. And, you know, I didn't go into it thinking I want to be a songwriter. You know, and I mean, it's just two very different approaches, I think. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with saying I want to be a songwriter, but, you know, I was making up songs before I knew what a songwriter was. You know, and it just happened that way. I think maybe that has given me an advantage over somebody who decides I want to be a songwriter and then learns how to write songs.
Right. The motivation is different.
You know, I don't want to sound like an asshole toward those people, but yeah, there's a difference in wanting to be a writer and needing to write.
Well, you're describing the difference between an artist and a performer.
Yeah, or a craftsman, yeah.
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 And I think that's true. I think that the art that people respond to most is art that had to be made.
Needed to happen.
It wasn't...
Exactly. It wasn't aimed in a certain direction. It wasn't thrown at a certain target audience. It just... I need to make this. Once it's made, I can throw it out the fucking window, whatever. But I need to make this.
I wanted to ask, at what point in the process your self-critic rears its head the most?
Oh, whenever I let him out of the cage. Like, it's my job. Sorry. It's my job to keep him chained up for a good as long as I possibly can. Because if not, he'll get in there and start... rustling the papers before I've even got anything written on them.
It sounds like you've had some experience with that cage.
Yes, and I think that's what a lot of people mistakenly call writer's block. I don't think there's writer's block. I just think you're unable to enjoy the work that you're doing. You can still write. It's not like you forget the words or how to put a pencil on a piece of paper. You just aren't having any fun anymore because you let that guy out of the cage too soon.
And what does he do? He reads it back to you and tells you how bad it is.
Yes, this is ridiculous, you know, and you can't even move on. You can't get anywhere. But, yeah, I try to get at least a third of the way into it. You know, on a good day, I'll get a whole draft of a song written before I'll go back and start crossing things out, but that's rare. Most of the time I'm halfway done and I'm going back and going, oh, this first line's got to go, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you ever wonder if you've thrown away some really good things if you just did?
No. I like not being completely insane.
No. That's the definition of insane.
That would drive me nuts.
So
man.
You have to have an
kidding?
Opinion.
Yeah.
So you sort of have to let the self-critic have his day too.
For sure, that he's very important part of the process.
Right, yeah,
But you can't let him get there too early. You
right.
Gotta keep him back for a while, and then, you know, you get to the end of a draft. If you can get through one draft of a whole song, then yes, please come out and join me, you know. And he gets to go for as hard, for as long as he wants to. You know, the editing part is that's the big deal right there. You know, for some people, it's like less magical if you have to edit. I don't give a shit because I know that all of the real magic happens from the craft, from the work, from actually putting the work in. The stuff you're talking about earlier, the things that make my stories sound more universal, the perspective, the everything about it that you like as a listener comes from somebody really sweating over that word and just... You know, some people are quick with it. Some people make it look like it just flew down out of the sky. But that craft is what's really doing it. It's not even where I grew up or how I grew up or any sort of legitimacy about my background. Even though I was lucky enough to have a really good story coming from Muscle Shoals, you know, all that, that's not what makes a song any good. You know, nobody cares. You can be completely manufactured. You can make all that up. Look at Dylan. He made all his backstory up.
Right.
You know, you could totally bullshit, but if you can do the work and you can do the editing and you can make it what you want it to be, then that story is true for everybody across the board. And if you can't, it doesn't matter if you, you know, have the greatest backstory in the world and every reason to be a legitimate artist. You're nothing. To me, it's not any less magical. It's even more magical, and maybe that's because of my experience with doing that kind of work myself. You know, when I find out about somebody's process, it's more magical to me than if it just fell out of the sky, you know?
Right.
I want to know how you got from a blank sheet of paper to blowing in the wind.
Yeah.
You know, right. I don't want to hear God gave you that. I want to know where you found it. What rock did you look under?
That's right. Well, it feels like you have a confidence in what you do, and you know, the musicians that I've been lucky enough to know, the true artists, they love to perform, they love to communicate through performing, and I get the sense that it's just something that's second nature to you, that it is, it's part of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't be leading up to all this if I wasn't going to ask you to play a song for me because...
Yes, I'll play a song.
I feel like...
It'd be awesome if I couldn't now. I was like, yeah. I don't know, man. This is weird.
No, but 99% of the time, you know, you see a musician perform on stage, but the way you grew up, you sat around with your family playing to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an amazing way to hear a song. So I would just be honored if you'd play a song.
I'll play a song for you. Just so happens there's a guitar, a beautiful
That's right.
guitar. It's yours, and it's an old Martin. It's a beauty. And it's small, so I'm going to look huge.
That's right. It'll make you look like a giant.
Yeah.
Well, it's the opposite of your childhood, where you had to play the giant dreadnought.
I had to play the tiny. Big, huge guitar, and I was tiny. My granddad would say, "You're getting the lazy arm." And I'd be reaching around this huge guitar. I wish I'd have had something like this back then. All right, let's see. Not the long flowing dress that you're in, or the light coming off of your skin, the fragile heart you've protected for so long, or the mercy in your sense of right and wrong. It's not your hand searching slow and dark, or your nails leaving love's watermark. It's not the way you talk me off the roof. Your questions like directions to the truth. It's knowing that this can't go on forever. Likely one of us will have to spend some days alone. Maybe we'll get 40 years together, but one day I'll be gone. One day you'll be gone. If we were vampires and death was a joke, we'd go out on the sidewalk and smoke, laugh at all the lovers and their plans. I wouldn't feel the need to hold your hand. Maybe time running out is a gift. I'll work hard till the end of my shift to give you every second I can find, and hope it isn't me who's left behind. Knowing that this can't go on forever, likely one of us will have to spend some days alone. Maybe we'll get 40 years together, but one day I'll be gone. One day you'll be gone. Some days alone. Maybe we'll get 40 years together, but one day I'll be gone. One day you'll be gone.
God, I love that song.
Thank you.
That was a treat. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you very much.
You know, that song is interesting to me because it's a love song, and yet it's a new perspective in a love song, which must be a hard thing to do, to come up with a sentiment in a love song that hasn't been said before. And what I love about that song is that you're basically saying, the reason we say I love you, the reason we cherish each other, is because we're aware of our own death.
Right.
And it's beautiful. When you came up with that, Like, was there a problem in your head? Like, how can I make a love song? How can I make a song that doesn't feel like something I've heard before? Or did that just sort of hit you over the head one day?
No, it was definitely that, like the former. I sat down and thought about the idea of like deconstructing, you know, a love song like somebody would a dish that they're trying to make differently at a restaurant. Like, okay, what are the things that people very often say in songs? You know, it's how you look, it's the way you look tonight, or, you know, it's how you love me, or I love how you take care of me, or what you're there for, you support me. And so I started with all those things, and even in the finished lyric of the song, you know, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this. By the time I got to the chorus, I was like, what is it? Really? Really, why do I care? Why does anybody care about anybody else enough to make themselves this vulnerable and this open to attack from all angles at all times? And it's, well, this is it. This is all we get. We get this time on earth, and then that's it. We don't know what's next, if anything, you know. And so then it almost became a love song to death itself, you know. But when that chorus hit, it was like, oh, well, there it is, you know. And, I mean, after that, it was just, you know, like I knew I had a good song. I knew I had a good song. And most of the time I don't know until, you know, I've sang it for Amanda a few times and sat with it for a week. And that one, it was like, oh my God, you have to come, you have to let me play this song.
Wow.
Even after all, you know, after writing songs for decades, it's like sometimes you're just like looking for the first person that, you know, first person in the house. You're like, you have to hear this right now. You know, I know you're a cat, but you have to listen to this song. And then I couldn't sing it, you know. Then I get halfway through it and start crying so much that I would just have to sit the guitar down and cry for a second.
Really?
Yeah. Took me half a dozen attempts to even sing it for my wife. It's just like when you're a kid, you make a macaroni sculpture or something, and you're running around showing it to your parents. You know, it's that level of excitement. And you know, I just feel bad for people that don't get to do that in their jobs, because most people don't, you know. I've always, like, when I was doing manual labor jobs before I was making any money as a musician, I'd always rather, you know, cut somebody's grass than work on an assembly line, because then you can look back behind you and go, that's not my grass, but I cut it, and it looks great, you know, and then you go on to the next yard. You know, and with the song, there's something so fulfilling about, that was nothing. I was watching Hoarders 3 hours ago, and you know, and it's Friday afternoon,
and then this song exists,
and now that is in the world, and yeah, it's just like, it's like a dog with a dead animal leaving it on your front porch. You're so excited. I did this. I killed this bird. Now I want you to have it. No matter if you got any use for it or not. I just want you to have it.
Well, I would say that you're both a lucky man, and it's completely earned and deserved. And I feel so happy to have discovered your music, and I'm just grateful to get to know you a little bit. And
well,
I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for coming and doing this.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. I thought it was great. I had a good time. I appreciate you having me.
Of course. Thank you very much. Hey folks, that's our show. That was a real treat for me, and I hope you enjoyed that. I encourage you all to check out not only Jason's latest record, The Nashville Sound, but to listen to his whole catalog as a solo artist and with the 400 Unit and also with the Drive-By Truckers. And he's out on the road right now, so if you have the opportunity, I implore you to go see him live, because he's the real deal. I also encourage you to check out offcamera.com, where you can find all kinds of information about Jason and about the other 140-something guests that we've had on the show. If you haven't been to the site lately, I encourage you to poke around and get more involved in what we're doing. Not only do we make this podcast, but of course, like we said at the beginning, Off Camera is a television show and also a magazine. You can subscribe to the television show right there at offcamera.com, and you can also visit the offcamera.com store, where you can get the magazine, you can get a subscription, you can even get a copy of our big new coffee table book, Off Camera, The Portraits.
In it, you'll find over 275 pages of exclusive photographs of all the artists that have appeared on this show. It makes a great gift, and it's also a great way to support what we're doing here. So if you like what we're doing, please take a minute, go to offcamera.com, check us out, tell your friends, and hey, go on social media, tell everyone about us. If you like what we're doing, don't keep it a secret. We are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. And if you check out those sites, you can see what we're doing behind the scenes. You can see the photographs we take of each guest. And it's a fun way to keep up with the show. So check all that out. And be sure to join me next time when I sit down with comedian and writer John Mulaney.
When I was 9 years old, I'd go buy a magazine and go to a diner and read it. And I thought, this is normal. And that must have looked very weird. Very weird for a kid to come in and go like, I'll have a glass of water, please. Just read a magazine. I was like, don't hassle me. I'm not a kid, you know. I am a citizen. I should be able to walk down the street. Conversely, I like knew adults had control over me and I couldn't stand it. To the point that I was like, well, I guess it's just us versus them.
Were you like a nervous kid?
Yeah, I've been nervous for 35 years.
Are you nervous now?
My fists are clenched.
Although I was unaware of it, John Mulaney had been making me laugh for years with his sharp and often absurd writing on Saturday Night Live, creating characters like Stefan and Herb Welch, both brilliantly brought to life by former off-camera guest Bill Hader. But the Chicago-born Mulaney's first love was always stand-up. And from the age of 5, he coveted the life of none other than Ricky Ricardo, where he thought he could sit around at home all day and pop down to the nightclub in the evening for a tight 10-minute set. Mulaney's whip-smart and very personal comedy is anchored firmly in his upbringing, where he mines the absurdities and peculiarities of his parents, his school experiences, and his marriage. And with his most recent Netflix special, Kid Gorgeous, he has perfected the art of telling the truth hilariously. See you next time, off camera.